extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Welcome, everybody, to Extra Time Club and Country, driven by Continental from the AT&T 5G Studios in the greatest city in the world. David Goss, Matt Doyle, and Kalen Carr with you from a glorious night of World Cup qualifying. You get 3 points. You get 3 points. Canada gets 3 points. USA gets 3 points. Everyone's a winner for this World Cup qualifying round. And the one thing we learned, guys, the one thing we know is no one knows anything. And that is where we stand. And I feel great about the world we live in. Ricardo Pepi, I don't know, 9 goals, 3 assists in his game. Richie Larea, 9 goals, 4 assists in his game. Someone talk me down right now because there's a chance that I'm gone.
I feel like you knew it because on the pregame spaces, you were like, I'm way more confident that the U.S. are going to get a win in this game than you were going into either of the first two games. And so obviously you and Greg had a little talk at halftime, said stop playing possum, need to make a couple of subs and get the right players out there in the right spots. And number one player of the game, number one star is Ricardo Pepi. Number two star, David Goss. This was David Goss's work.
Is there really difference between the two? I mean, both of them have spent equal amount of time at the GA Cup over the years. So I feel like we should have seen this coming.
Oh, Kalen, you said the magic words. GA Cup undefeated. Brendan Aaronson, Ricardo Pepi. This is what we do.
But I mean, let's do this. I want to do the macro thing first. Like, so many of the players who have been good for both the U.S. and not just good, but like excellent for both the U.S. and Canada are guys who have come through the academy system and guys who have, been brought through an MLS pipeline. And to see Tyler Adams through 3 games, I mean, I don't think he has made a single mistake. Alphonso Davies, a Vancouver Whitecaps product, is clearly the best player in CONCACAF. Ricardo Pepi doing what he did tonight at 18 on the road in a World Cup qualifier. This is when I started following MLS before MLS even existed. This is what I was hoping for. I wanted to see a league that could produce players like this, get them in the academy from the time that they're 10 or 12 years old and get them into the first team and get them onto the international stage to try to lead their team, their country to a World Cup. This is what I dreamed of our league being. And it felt like this qualifying round, Brendan Aaronson had 2 goals. It was huge for that. Sam Adekugbe, he's a Vancouver Whitecaps product, never really played with Vancouver, but he's been great for Canada. These are the stories that are going to drive Canadian and U.S. soccer forward. And it was just wonderful to see all night. If you're Canadian, it was wonderful to see basically throughout this first series of qualifiers. If you're American, you were probably a little bit antsy up until that last half of soccer. But it felt good to watch. I've been waiting a long time for it, and it feels good that it's finally here.
The first 45 minutes for U.S. versus Honduras, the best player on the field was Andy Nahar, an MLS
That's
Academy
a really good
grad.
Point. That's a really good point.
And it might be the second game where he was, too. So as you said, the MLS Academy system is robust and strong right now. Okay, there's a million things people want to talk about. Let's start with the big one. Kalen Carr, Ricardo Pepi, man. The Savior, come down from the gods to grace us with his presence. What do you make of what just happened, which is he was the second youngest debutant for a World Cup qualifier in history behind Christian Pulisic, who I think did it in an earlier round. So it wasn't in the hex for him. It was earlier. And then I think he's the first player ever to score in his debut in a World Cup qualifier since Eddie Johnson, which might mean that's the pathway we're on, baby, which I am feeling the vibes of EJ right now. Kalen, what do you make of what we just saw from this young man?
Well, I think just to kind of go back to what Doyle was talking about and the progression and player pathway and just sort of the time that it would take for players to be able to work their way into the national team, it would take a long time to discover talent like that. And a lot of guys got lost in the process. And I would say, even when you look at this team and you mentioned Brandon Aaronson, it really took for him to get that move to Europe and then play well there and then start playing in the Champions League. And now you see his progression, how quickly he's actually really upped his game. And I think if you look over the last three matches, Aaronson has been one of the standouts as far as a guy where you're saying, you know, can he help out? I think he can actually, clearly we're seeing he can help us secure a place in the World Cup, which is a big role. But Pepe is a different story because he's a player that is still in MLS, has not been transferred, although I would imagine the price tag is just continuing to rise at this point. But he's a player that, you know, this season has really broken out. And I believe now he has, 11 goals in for FC Dallas. Just fantastic finishers. And for those who have been watching him play with his club side, you'd be able to see some of this quality throughout. He can score with both feet from inside, outside the box. He can stretch the field. Showed a lot of grit tonight, a lot of fight, even when the game really wasn't going on our way and when the system was clearly not set up well to suit him. But as the game went on, you found that little bit of quality from him that the other number nines just didn't have. And PFOC, yes, he's had the one header in the Nations League. That was an important goal. But here, you know, it's a fantastic ball from Yedlin, who came in, did a good job. But just he's got a range of abilities. And I think also just that personality that you could see in him, that he wants to win the match. He wants to be the match winner. And that's what we've been craving from a number nine, somebody that would just take the game or take that moment, take that chance when he had it. And then he gets the assist and just, you know, creates the other one as well that Legette ended up putting on. So totally turned the games on its head. And for a young player who you still have to remember is just still a teenager, unbelievable performance. And if you're the manager of Berhalter, you got to go over and give the kid a big hug today, because he put in a big time performance in a tough situation. So hats off to Pepe tonight.
So Kalen, you kind of brought us into it. It's what everyone's going to talk about. It wasn't great from the start. And then at halftime, Greg Berhalter makes three changes. He changes the formation. He changes the personnel, obviously forced into some other changes because of injuries with Christian Pulisic. Doyle, what do you make of Greg Berhalter's day today and whether and his window in total, but mainly clearly he got it wrong, but to his credit, he didn't stick to it. And then he got it right.
So it's one of the things that I thought he did well in the Gold Cup was make changes at half to, or usually around the hour mark. And that kind of deserted him the first two. Well, I thought he made some good changes late against El Salvador, not so much against Canada. In this game, he did it right, but it was one of those things where he got it so wrong at the start that there was almost no way to go, nowhere to go but up. Part of it was tactical, right? The 4-3-3, I think, is a little bit more familiar for them. I think the U.S. does play a little bit better when there's a single pivot rather than a double pivot. You know, Sands and Acosta working together were not in sync at all, and we're completely separated from the front line. But the other part of it was just getting the underperforming guys off the field. Josh Sargent doesn't look like, at this point, he doesn't look like an international caliber player. John Brooks, there are times where he looks like he should be the first name written down on any team sheet. But if you look at the goal Canada scored, and then you look at the goal Honduras scored, he was largely culpable on both. Not saying exclusively culpable. Goals are always a team-wide break, almost always a team-wide breakdown. There are always other guys who, you know, have part of the blame. And you're seeing the goal now. If you're watching this on YouTube, like George Bello should have recognized that and come over and mark the guy. But like, if you're John Brooks and you're in the middle of a back five, you can't walk into midfield like that, completely miss the challenge, and then just like sort of walk back. So honestly, getting those guys off, getting Anthony Robinson in for George Bello, I thought, you know, Bello looked like a 19-year-old playing his first, you know, his first World Cup qualifier. He was a little overwhelmed. Robinson in two games was fantastic. And he's a guy who I had a ton of question marks about. And I know that Greg Berhalter did too. So, you know, he ended up answering those. And then, you know, getting the early goal in the second half was obviously huge. And then, I mean, for whatever reason, they had the confidence after that to just start playing a little bit more free and taking the kind of risks that you need to take in order to put the ball in the back of the net. Like, you can't move the ball slow. You can't be so conservative with your positioning at wing back or fullback. Like, at some point, you have to stress the other team. And the U.S. were really afraid to do that through 2.5 games. And second half of this game, especially the last 20 minutes, that fear evaporated. And they played like the team that we all want them to be. It wasn't perfect. It wasn't pretty, but it doesn't, like, it's not going to be pretty on the road to World Cup qualifying. But it was ruthless and it was effective. And I think, you know, we'd all drink to that.
And it was historic.
Mm-hmm.
We do not win on the road in World Cup qualifying.
So that's not entirely true, right? We won in Honduras, I think, 3 straight times. The 02, 06.
Oh, but not the last 10.
10 cycles.
Right.
But our last win in Central America in World Cup qualifying was, I think, the Sanssouci goal.
Ooh,
right?
Nice.
Was there in this round of World Cup qualifying? We might have won
like
at
in Guatemala. Yeah.
Or the, actually,
but I don't think we did.
No, I don't think we did. I think
sorry, I don't think the U.S. did.
Yes, thank you.
You're a Canada fan, obviously.
I'm a Canada fan, yeah.
So you're talking about a whole different thing.
So the last win the U.S. had in World Cup qualifying in Central America, I'm pretty sure was the Sanssouci goal, and that was a lifetime ago.
It was 8 years ago.
And this was a multi-goal win. I mean, that doesn't happen in Central America. It felt big. And it certainly made a big difference in the standings.
You see the standings. We'll hit Canada a ton coming up. It was a big window for Canada as well. Obviously, the U.S. and Canada both sitting on 5 points. Did it a little differently, and we'll talk about that. So, Kalen, where you sit right now, 5 points, making the changes to win this second game, was this a good window for Greg Berhalter and his team, or was this a bad one?
I think it was acceptable. 5 points was an acceptable window, and it looked like it was heading towards disaster. So I think, based on where you were, about where we all were, or where
everyone
the rest
knows
team
it's always
was
darkest before
45
the
minutes ago, was literally a tale of two halves. And you can give Berhalter credit for the second half and the adjustments he made, because I think every single player that came on almost ended up contributing to a goal, whether goal or assist. And made some changes, but the first half was just a nightmare. It almost looked as if we didn't have a midfield. It was just completely disarray. And Joy, when you mentioned like taking some of the players off, I understand that. But at the same point, a manager's job is to put your players in a position to succeed. And I did not feel like this team was in anywhere close to a position to succeed today, because yes, you're going to start with Pepe up front, right? And that's a good chance that I think a lot of people were calling for, especially when we see the number nines who'd yet to really sort of grab that position. But then you're asking Sargent to play outright, and I understand for Norwich he plays there a little bit, but it's also not necessarily his best position as well there. And then you're switching formations, Bellows coming into the team, playing with a three, like the back line to me, it just got way overcomplicated. And I think when we've seen things go wrong for Berhalter, that's generally the trend in the way it's gone wrong, where he's sort of overthinking these positions and personnel decisions. And it just clearly did not work. I don't think there's much debate about that. But no. The problem for me was it just didn't need to be that complicated. You play 4-3-3, you already played Brooks and Robinson together, right? So you're going to keep them into the team. That's your center right there. And then Anthony Robinson was fantastic last game. Why is he coming off the bench in a must-win game in San Pedro Sula?
I don't think he's been coming off the bench much anymore, man.
Sure. And then Tyler Adams, you're already missing Weston McKennie. You need that. You know the middle of midfield is going to be so important. I understand. Yes, you need. I don't know what the status of DeAndre Yedlin is. He ends up coming in and doing fantastic, but it's almost like the back line that what we lacked so much earlier in the first two matches in when it wasn't working out was that connection, that continuity, those relationships were not working. So then to just kind of like throw everything against the wall and try and hope something sticks, it clearly didn't work out, but credit halftime. We called for substitutions earlier in the Canada match that didn't happen. This time, he makes the changes right at halftime. You come right out, new energy. Robinson gets that first one, which completely changed the game. And Christian Pulisic comes out. Substitution, obviously you're forced at that point to make a substitution, but Roldan comes in. You get these guys coming out there and players are ready. And when they took the, when they came in and the system started to fit, you actually saw kind of how this US team can play. So credit to the guys for fighting and credit to Greg for making the changes, but it makes me nervous a little bit because the first half was so wrong.
It was. And he got stuff wrong against El Salvador to start this window that I think had a knock-on effect and made it harder throughout. And I'm just glad that Tyler Adams and Miles Robinson made it through these three games in one piece and with their hamstrings intact. And I hope both of these guys get the weekend off because they I think there was a way for them to not have to play 270 minutes each. And with the choices that Berhalter made, it was tough to get to that point. And so they had to play 270 minutes.
So we came into this summer, we wondered who would be the starting center back. Miles Robinson steps up. Who would be the starting left back? Anthony Robinson steps up. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is, Robbie Robinson, get ready, because the red carpet is about to be rolled out. Robinson is always the answer to any question associated to the U.S. men's national team.
At the rate that we're losing wingers, there is a clear path for him, because we finished this game with our fifth and seventh choice wingers on the depth. I mean, Pulisic, Reyna, Weah, Morris, all hurt. Then presumably Aaronson is fifth. Ariola's hurt. That's sixth. And then Roldan comes in. He's apparently seventh ahead of Conrad, who's eight. The amount of attrition on the wings and obviously up top as well. Weston McKennie and Yunus Musah, who we all think are probably, two of the best central midfield. I would throw Paxton Pomykal in as well. None of those guys really fit enough or available enough in Weston's case to contribute. So the amount of attrition and going down the list, I think other than, being in second place after three games, I think the biggest takeaway for the U.S., the biggest positive is that so many of these players have been blooded now. So many of these players now have World Cup qualifying experience. And the next window is another three-game window. And so I'm assuming the rotations will be better. I'm hoping there will be better health. And I'm hoping there will be fewer nerves. Because they have, 20-odd players have seen the field. Guys got their debuts in these games that matter so much. And I think that once you've done that once, it gets, I don't want to say easier, but it gets more familiar. The stuff that you have to deal with, and we'll talk to Charlie about this because he's actually experienced it himself, but the stuff that you have to deal with emotionally and mentally gets more manageable. And I think, the guys I've talked to, they say once you have that under your belt, you can start thinking about the game a little bit more. And that makes a huge difference when you have the talent advantage.
And to be clear, part of what we're talking about through this early part of qualifying is not the schedules are, they're not all even. So Canada had a 5-point window and the U.S. had a 5-point window, and they were two very different experiences. Next window for the U.S. is Jamaica at home at Q2 Stadium in Austin. It's at Panama, and then it's Costa Rica at home. I think that one is in Cincinnati. So it is, and we have the standings. We put them up before, but I'm pretty sure you're playing the two lowest teams now in the standings at home, and they're going to Panama, who's had a phenomenal window. But it's a completely different experience than what you just went through for the U.S. We haven't hit this one player as hard, so I wanted to bring in the legend Morgan Tenza's tweet. Shout out Morgs, who her tweet says, "My thoughts, all caps, Brendan Aaronson. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk." He's been awesome this window. And this is where I see with the U.S., people ask, well, what do you think is going to happen here and here? And I think a lot of the unknown is there's so much talent coming through. And a year ago, Brendan Aaronson wasn't on the national team, and now it feels like, Kalen, he's a locked-in starter.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at, I mentioned Aaronson earlier, but, Clint Dempsey in the post game, I think, called him Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde because that first match with El Salvador and then the second match against Canada. And then tonight it was just Mr. Hyde, right? Like, it's just, he's sort of, you see that consistency building. But it goes back to my comment as well as putting players in a position to succeed. In that first match, Brendan Aaronson played an attacking midfield role as opposed to a winger role, which he's much better suited to with that energy and the pressure system and getting close to goal. Is like setting up plays, slipping people in, finishing plays himself, pressuring. That's where he's suited best. So when you put players in good positions, you're going to find success, and at least you give them a chance or you give them a platform to do it. And Brendan Aaronson, I think, has showed as the matches go on, this was a huge, huge goal here, right? Because 87th minute, this one puts it away, and then it carries them on forward to now they can move up to third from goal difference. And who knows how it goes, and hopefully we don't leave it to goal difference for all of our just sort of mental health and physical health, spiritual health, and all that. But it even just for the team who have had a very difficult window from distractions and absences and injuries and losing Christian in this one, and you're sort of calling, you've got this 19-year-old kid, Pepe, who steps up in this, but then you're just looking for more names that can step forward and say, hey, when the game is tough, when we're in the toughest of environments, who can you depend on here? And we've seen him step up with Champions League. We've seen him do it in Major League Soccer. And we're seeing it now with the national team, that at every measure, he's been ready to take that next step in his development. And it doesn't really seem overawed by the moment at all. And is now one of the guys that I think other players will look to and say, Brendan, we need a moment here. And he's been able to provide that. So, big time performance for him. And I think building that consistency of one after the next.
It's one of those, if you're good enough, you're old enough type of things. And he's shown that for his club, you know, both with the Union, because he was a huge part of that run to the Supporter Shield and, you know, scoring Champions League goals with RB Salzburg. And now, what he did this window for a kid his age, he's still just 20 years old. Right? Yeah, he doesn't turn 21 till next month.
Yikes, he's ancient.
Yeah, right? It's huge, and it's really nice to see. I was also really happy for Christian Roldan and Sebastian Legette. These two guys in particular get more crap than they deserve online, and I know they're aware of it. Legette has actually talked about it. They were excellent. Legette in particular, he had one of those. He hasn't had a game like this in a few months for the U.S., not since really the March window, I don't think. But he got in there and he knows his limitations as an athlete, but he's a really clever soccer player. And he was feeling himself a little bit, and he kind of opened the game for the rest of the guys. And he was one of the ones who I noticed coming right out of the break, taking up, I think, a little bit more advanced positions and being a little bit riskier and kind of showing the confidence, not only that he could pull off the play, but that his teammates were going to win the ball and get him the ball in good spots to make stuff happen. He was a huge difference maker. I think he had a goal and assist. Roldan, I think it was Roldan who came on for Pulisic, and then he created the turnover on that Aaronson goal, I believe. Yeah. And he's just such a, he's a winner. I don't think he's lost yet this year. I think he's played something like, I think he's played like 27 games.
No, you are correct. Country,
and he hasn't lost yet, which I know there's like a correlation.
They lost to Portland. I knew they lost.
That's right. Go Timbers. Yeah. So he's lost once, but like that's an absurd record. You play almost 30 times and you lose one game. So I was happy for those guys. Mostly I was happy to see this team play the way so many people so many people want to see them play with that ruthlessness and a bit of a aesthetic appeal as well.
In danger of getting in trouble, if Sebastian Legette's going to play like that, I'm going to promote his product, which is DuBois scented candles sitting up there. Shout out to Susan Marshall for my girlfriend's birthday gift. You know what it smells like? It smells like 3 points.
Oh, wow. Ooh, yeah, Roldan is a winner, and I think for him, the formula for making this World Cup team is to continue to be that X factor game breaker off the bench. I think there'll be times where he'll be called upon to start. I actually thought he had a good bet to maybe do that tonight. I was a little disappointed that he wasn't involved from the start, but
it is shocking that him and Legette didn't start a game on the road in World Cup qualifying.
And that's that goes back to what I was saying with Berhalter, I think, making some bad choices against El Salvador and making it harder on himself than I think he needed it to. But to your point, Kalen, the fact that Roldan didn't start, do you think that maybe he needs his own scented candle? Do you think that's what would push him over the top?
I don't know. I'd have to be sent a free copy of that first to test it out myself.
A free sample.
Yeah, free sample, exactly. But Legette, he at his best, he is so often the one that makes the pass that makes the pass. And we saw even earlier in qualifying, I think it was the Canada game, actually, this last match, where he kind of turns in the box and finds Aaronson, and Aaronson plays it to Pulisic, who hits it off the post. You almost forget at times that it's Legette the one that's either switching the point of attack or making the play in the box to set somebody up next. And then he has a little bit of a knack to get around the goal himself, too. So I think a really useful player that can help us a lot. And we just so desperately needed some sort of possession, simplicity in the midfield, or even presence. I thought James Sands had a really rough evening. Just did not seem comfortable. And again, another guy that was asked to, I know he plays there quite often for his club team with NYCFC, but with the national team, he played center back almost exclusively. I think actually only exclusively. And so this was a first time playing in a position in a tough environment that just didn't suit him. And I don't think he has the athleticism either to play that role, at least the way the US play, where you really do have to get up and around the pitch. And even some uncharacteristic turnovers with the ball in possession where he's usually so clean. And we've seen Jackson Ewell struggle in that same role, where guys that are generally very clean on the ball end up in some of these circumstances where the game just moves a little bit faster, and at the international level, it just kind of catches you off guard and you just looked uncomfortable. And I thought that was a change that when it was made eventually, and we saw Yedlin come in at right back, move Adams to center midfield, was one that I would have liked to see in a half. But again, I'm not going to overly be critical here and complain. And the second half substitutions all clearly
wanted
worked.
5-1 win.
I wish I didn't have so much anxiety watch through like along with everybody else. But it ended up working out. And I think Legette and Roldan also deserve some credit as some of the changes alongside Robinson, who took his chance super well with his off foot and threw a little backflip too, which
was awesome.
I don't know. I hadn't seen a backflip. Like usually you get a little run up or anything, but he just threw that thing. So, hey, when you're feeling
We haven't talked about Mark McKenzie at all, and that's probably a good thing, right? Because we talked about him a lot after his last U.S. appearance, which was the win over Mexico in the Nations League final. Of course, he had the early giveaway in that one that led to the first Mexico goal. He had a bunch of other giveaways. In this one, he came out in the first half like everyone else on the U.S. He stunk, and he had one bad giveaway, and I thought, here we go again. But he locked it down from there. He locked it down, and I was actually kind of concerned when he – even though John Brooks had not had a very good first half, I was concerned when Brooks was brought off at halftime instead of McKenzie. But McKenzie and Robinson together in that second half, I thought, did a very good job. I thought he handled the physicality very well, and that's something on the road in CONCACAF can always be an issue, but especially against Honduras. Honduras will bury you physically if you give them an inch. And this is a kid who has been struggling with his team in Belgium. Like he's not a starter. I think he played all of 78 minutes in August. They weren't good minutes. It's why he is no longer a starter. So for him to come in and do the job like this, that's a really good sign for Mark McKenzie and for the U.S. national team. And it goes back to that broader picture of, so many guys, whether they played well or not, so many guys got their first taste of World Cup qualifying. And I'm pretty confident that McKenzie, Bello, Sands, Pepe will be better prepared, will be even more ready for it next time. Though I don't know that Pepe can be any better than he was in the second half tonight. But I, I, I do think that that is an unambiguous good thing to take away from this window if you're a U.S. national team fan. And I'm sure Greg Berhalter probably feels the same way.
CBS just showed Pepe's goal, and I didn't realize he had gotten knocked over in the box as the ball cycled across the top and got himself back up. I've said for 2.5 years now that Beasley and Donovan had Reyna and Pope and McBride to lean on, and then Bradley and Dempsey had those guys to lean on, and Bocanegra, and these players don't have that. But we're hosting the next World Cup in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And after that, it seems like an expanded one. So this is kind of it for learning how to get through CONCACAF World Cup qualifying.
I kind of hate that.
I know. I do too. And it might be ugly, and it has been ugly, and it will be ugly. But once these players come through, I don't believe this is a golden generation. And I believe every generation after this will have these players to lean on if they can find success. And tonight was about that.
I'll say this with the I wish that we still had those players to help some of these young players along and find their way and find their footing and take some of that leadership or take that burden off of them. But I do think that, you know, we opened the show talking a little bit about that player pathway and understanding the structure and the environment of being in it, where these players have been in professional environments at high pressure places for quite a while. And that changes the dynamic quite a bit where you look, you know, I think we talked to Ricardo Pepi and I interviewed him in El Paso and we talked about his story a lot. He chose at 13 years old to leave his family in El Paso to move to Dallas to go play with the academy and lived with the academy system, then takes the entire player pathway where he goes through the USL in North Texas and plays there, scores goals in the playoffs, plays against men, you know, and then eventually gets his opportunity with the first team and then starts banging him in from there. So he's really, you know, he's 19 years old, but he's been playing as a professional, left home since he was 13 years old. Like, so when you go into these environments, he has that level of maturity. I also just think he's a special kid and kind of has that personality of just like, you know, we saw him at the All-Star game, score the game winning penalty. It sounds silly, but it's like, whatever. But still, like that for a 19 year old, if you hadn't had 18, some of those 18, there's, I see I'm overvaluing. Okay. 18 years old. Like that's still, that's not a normal thing necessarily to be doing. And I just feel that he has that sense of maturity. I think the same thing with Brendan Aaronson. You talk to guys in Philly about kind of what he was like as a young player, not afraid to dribble guys or do his thing, express himself. Like that really, that personality is really what you need. And the infrastructure around him has helped kind of give him that platform. And we're, so it doesn't replace the know-how of like, you know, you see the CBS where you got Chuck and Deuce and Gooch and those guys, like, it doesn't replace the know-how of some of those guys giving you that or being walking into a camp and seeing some established names, but it can help you to be able to be more ready than players maybe in the past have.
What's tired is being hyped about Brendan Aaronson. What's new is being hyped about Paxton Aaronson. And the future the future is bright. Doyle, you mentioned you and Kalen both mentioned high-level players. What's Greg Berhalter supposed to do when Sergiño Dest, who plays for Barcelona, and John Anthony Brooks, who's a Champions League starter and was arguably the best center back in the Bundesliga last year, don't play well? Like, what is, you bench them. Just coming into camp, next camp, they come in. Sergiño Dest plays 3 La Liga games, let's say, and then you bench them?
I mean, yeah. That's the way it has to be. It can't, you have to do it for the national team when you come play here. You can't be responsible for giving up a goal a game. And it you know, it happened tonight. Jess Sargent is a Premier League striker. He's a Bundesliga striker. He got benched. You know, like Jordy Pefox, he's in the Champions League with young boys. He got benched for an 18-year-old who's actually doing it. It's just I don't think anyone is beyond that. You know, like maybe Tyler Adams is because he's just so clearly so much better than any other option at the six. But even that is like he proved it, you know, with the way he played. So I'm sorry, there can't be any sacred cows in this camp. Nobody here is Landon Donovan in the 2010 cycle. where you're like, okay, he's not performing for his club, or he had a rough half versus, you know, Mexico, you know, but it's Landon. We know he's still going to be the best player throughout this entire cycle. Nobody has that cred with this team, not even Christian Pulisic. So and I'm not saying that, you know, none of these players should ever be thrown in the trash. They're all so talented. But at some point, they have to back that up with performance for the national team. And the guys you mentioned have not. And so they can't be automatic starters. They just can't. And the same thing happened with Zach Steffen. Zach Steffen plays for Manchester City, or doesn't play. And Matt Turner outplayed him. Matt Turner's a starter now. That's the way it has to work.
So
if you look at anything over these last three matches too as well, if you look up the names and the clubs they're associated with, it doesn't matter in any of this. That's kind of what the big takeaway of these of CONCACAF qualifying is, right? And people tell you it and you do it, and then you go out there and you're saying, okay, Andy Nahar is the best player on the pitch. Like, and who cares his age, or he was on the bench or whatever.
He was getting dominated by Debbie Flores, who was caught by the Vancouver Whitecaps.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. None of that stuff matters.
Now he plays in the Greek League.
Right?
None of that stuff matters. And I think even when we saw off the field with Weston being sent home or left out or whatever, suspended, I don't know what the technical term would be for it, but it's like there has to be that sense of accountability where if you don't track your man or you don't follow the rules, whatever it is, like if you start letting that stuff go, then you really have a bigger problem. And so I think I agree. I also think that it is part of the job of the manager to get the best out of your best players.
Absolutely.
And to engage the best players. Because if you start throwing away John Anthony Brooks, or you start losing, Dest, or you
Serginho
start...
Serginho Dest or McKenna.
Serginho Dest, that's not doing your job. So it's a tough job as a manager. You have to do all of these things. You have to have the accountability to play anybody over everybody, whoever's in the best form. That's it. No questions asked. But you also need to get the best out of Serginho Dest. And that's still a question that we haven't seen answered yet.
Well, first for Greg Berhalter was to win games, and he finally did that. 5 points. We're going to move to Canada because it was an incredible window for them as well. Before we do that, though, Doyle, you mentioned Matt Turner right there in passing. For you too, is he the locked-in starter for the U.S. men's national team? I mean, he made one Matt Turner-esque save in this game, which was the only one he really had to make all window. Does any mindset change, or is it just you're impressed that he continues to do his thing?
No, I mean, so the save was great, but the thing with Matt Turner is that he doesn't make mistakes. He doesn't, and Bruce Arena has even said this, and Bruce Arena never praises goalkeepers. But he's like, he's like, Matt, he doesn't.
But can he save a lacrosse goal at Cornell in 1978?
He never costs you a game, and his long range distribution is actually a weapon.
The throw to Pulisic. Oh my God.
And a couple of, and he, you know, his right foot is good too when he's kicking it over 30 yards. When anything less than that, it can be a little bit dodgy. So he does limit the ability to play out the back, but I'm like, he doesn't make mistakes, and he makes spectacular saves when you need him to. I don't think there's any argument. Unless there's an injury at Manchester City and Steffen comes into the starting job and he plays so well for one of the three best teams in the world that you're like, okay, it's back to being an open competition for the October window. But as it stands now, unless there's an injury, it's Matt Turner playing 270 more minutes in October.
I'm not convinced Turner will keep the job in the long term. I think in the short term, I agree. And it goes back to our comments of just playing who's ever in the best form. And Matt Turner has been fantastic as of late. I felt I called for him to start this tournament, even when it was a question between the two of them. I do think the ceiling for the U.S. team and the way Berhalter wants to play is different for Zach Steffen. And I think against different competition where we really do want to play and build out of the back, I think Steffen gives you a different option. I think a lot of it will come down to seeing, can he get games? Will he end up in some more matches? He's going to sign for a new contract. What's going to happen with his situation with his club team? But right now I think it's Matt Turner's job. And out of all of the out of all of the sort of anxieties and people we lost and missed, there wasn't a lot of conversation about the goalkeeper or that we were going into this with a problem at all, which is a nice, I guess, non-existent problem to have. He was good. He was very good.
So Doyle set me up really well to transition, but then Kalen took over because he's a natural goal scorer, and that's what I would expect from a player like that. But I'll take my Brian Ching moment now. That October window that Matt Doyle just mentioned is going to start October 7th at Q2 Stadium against Jamaica for the U.S. Men's National Team. For anyone who wasn't paying attention, Jamaica has added about 10 dual nationals for the first time ever. With the whole England red list thing, all of them were coming from England. They did not play at Mexico. They all played at home, where Jamaica got smoked by Panama 3-0. They then did not play at Costa Rica in the game today, which they tied 1-1. That team was mainly MLS and USL players. So it'll be interesting to see what Jamaica's group looks like and how it all comes together and what they're doing going forward. And then, as I said, the U.S. will travel down to Panama in the middle of that three-game window, and then we'll head back to the U.S. to Ohio to play Costa Rica, who also only got 1 point out of this window, has really struggled, and there's a ton of question marks around the Ticos and what they are right now. So that's half of CONCACAF. Let's go to the other half. You like wins? You like goals? Then you like Canada. Matt Doyle, born and raised inside of a maple tree. His blood flows through with maple syrup, enjoying, relishing every moment of the first 10 minutes of this game. Canada jumps out to a 2-0 lead against El Salvador. This was clearly what John Herdman wanted against Honduras: to come out early, to be aggressive, to create chances at home. The atmosphere at BMO was phenomenal for this one. And then Canada gets those two early goals, Atiba Hutchinson and then Jonathan David with those first two. They play out the stretch of the rest of the first half, and then they get the cinch goal?
Insurance.
Cinched it.
Yeah, I don't know. Tejan Buchanan scored a goal. I don't know what to say there. Doyle, let's take your takeaway from this game first, and then we'll talk Canada window in general.
Canada, their attacking group is terrifying, even without Alphonso Davies and even without Kyle Larin. And that's the best player and arguably the best center forward in CONCACAF.
It's the leading center forward right now, leading goal scorer.
Yeah, and they, Jonathan David's out there, Tejan Buchanan, who looks like an absolute steal for Club Bruges. Richie Larea playing as sort of an inverted left wing back was dominant. Junior Hoylett, his shot pass decision making is still less than optimal, but he's one of those guys. We talked about the U.S. not having those guys who have been through it before and know a little bit about, you know, what it takes and what can go wrong. And Junior Hoylett has experienced that. And he has played a big role in this window, even though, I mean, he's well down the list of things that Canadian national team fans like myself are so excited about. And he, you know, his ability to fill that role and also be sort of a floor raiser for the guys who haven't experienced this before is huge. They just look like a very, very good team. That said, I mean, El Salvador were on the road for the first time. This is the third game in 7 days. This was an expected result. This was Canada going out there and taking care of business. Well done to them, because they have not traditionally done that in the past. But I think if you're a Canada fan, you don't want to get too high after this window. Because while the U.S. game was great and, you know, getting the 3 points here is great, they still dropped points, home points in that first game.
We still dropped home points in that first
game. Yeah, sorry. We.
Us, you can Canadian, use it. Yeah, you can use it now.
Still dropped points in that first game. And that's the type of thing that you have to sort of find a way to make up for over the course of the Ocho. That said, like, we Canadians have so much talent. This looks like a World Cup team to me. It really does. They look so good, and they are devastating anytime they get to start moving forward in numbers.
right as you were about to say temper your enthusiasm or curb your enthusiasm, I was getting ready to be like, they look like a World Cup team to me. They do. And I mean, you look at Canada teams in the past and maybe say, okay, yeah, some difference makers, but then maybe a bunch of guys that seem to be kind of carrying the lunch pail a bit. And this team, it looks completely different because it looks stacked throughout the pitch. And even when they're missing players or when they have options and the depth and, you know, against the U.S., it looked like they were the more likely team to come away with 3 points because of that depth, because of the weapons that they had to be able to bring off the bench. And, you know, I think in this one, even if you look at the back line, they haven't given up more than one goal in any of the World Cup qualifying, but then even dating back through the Gold Cup. So yeah. Defensively, they've been very stingy as well, which bodes well for them because we know that they have the top end talent, maybe probably individually at least, maybe the highest top end talent of the teams in the region. Although
I would take Davies, David, Laren, Buchanan over any foursome on any other team.
I think I would too. I think
there's a lot of Funes Mori haters right now who would agree.
and with Davies specifically, he is just such a game changer. And we've seen, you know, even if you just look around the world, one player with good talent around them can actually lift it. It's can't if they're that special. And I think Davies really is that special, can lift a team.
But he doesn't have to. I agree with you, Kalen. He's the best player in this region right now. But then you look at him go out there, and that's not totally his job.
Yeah, because right? if you push everything to that side, and then you have Buchanan down the other side, it's at least going to keep you honest. Or then you have Laren in the middle, or David in the middle. You can't make these crazy bets where you just push everything to one side, and that's all you do. He's going to give you one or two chances a game still, like we saw in the U.S. game.
If they play a 3-5-2 with David and Laren up top, and Davies on the left and Buchanan on the right, and then Eustachio, Atiba, and Kay or Osorio in central midfield, that is a nightmare because they have three central midfielders who can play you through, who can play through balls. And then they have, if you sell out on the right against Alphonso Davies, who is the best left wing back in the entire world, you sell out on your right side to stop him, that Buchanan is just going to bury you on the right side. And they have the midfielders to switch the ball, to switch play, and to find him in stride. Canada's a nightmare right now. And like, I watched this El Salvador team that I think we all kind of really admire for the way they want to play, come out and possess and try to take the game and dictate the game. And I think about 90 seconds into the game, I was like, they're going to give up 16 goals. You can't. I was surprised it was only three. Like and El Salvador, I thought actually played really well. But Canada are just so dynamic in those moments. And it's not just the guys we met. I mean, Jonathan Osorio on that first goal was absurd. This is a really good team. This is a really, really good team. And like Kalen said, the high end talent is maybe the best in CONCACAF, but it's that defense continuing to hold up and make it hard on everybody they play against. That is, I mean, if that's a foundation, Canada's in a really good spot.
And credit to Greg Berhalter because they won the U.S. won Nations League, and then he's basically built out two full rosters for the U.S. And we've seen that depth with these injuries. For John Herdman, you talked about rotations. He started two different back threes from game one to two and then back to three, and they only conceded two goals in that entire stretch, one from a penalty kick that was fairly soft and Tejan's fault, so you can't even blame the back three, and then one against the U.S. on the road. And that is with a back line that we thought was the weakness 2 years ago and that there were zero answers.
It was the weakness. I mean, you remember that Haiti game? Like that Haiti game in the Gold Cup. For those of you who are not, you know, Canadian super fans like myself, the Canada in the 2019 Gold Cup quarterfinals were up 2-0 on Haiti, and they were playing a back four with Davies on the left side and Marcus Gaudinho on the right side, and Alphonso Davies and Gaudino got smoked the entire second half, and they lost 3-2. And I thought it's just never going to happen for Canada. No matter how much talent this team has, it's just never going to. And that feels like a million years ago. And the other thing I want to say about, like, they've come so far in the past 2 years. But the other thing I want to say is think back to a week ago, that Honduras game. Tejan gives up the penalty. They go down 1-0. He gets yanked at halftime. And John Herdman comes to his senses and puts out a sensible lineup for the second half. You could have lost Tejan Buchanan there. You could have lost him. He could have said, you know, he could have pouted, whatever. Instead, he comes back and he was just so good against the U.S. when he got on against the U.S. And he was dominant tonight. Like, he ripped El Salvador apart tonight. And the fact that Herdman was able to rotate the squad like that, was able to bench a guy who just made a move to a Champions League team and have him buy in, even after the benching, that tells me something's going very right in the Canada camp, and it gives me a lot of confidence for what's from them for from what's to come.
So we got a ton of mailbag right now in Twitter as well as in the YouTube chat about Canada. I'm going to give you all of these. Kalen, pick which one you want to answer.
Okay.
Arturo says Canada will jump to top 15 in the world very soon. Reasonable USMNT on Twitter says, is Canada going to qualify? And Bielsa's High Press on Twitter, great name, says, where is this Canadian team going to finish in World Cup qualifying? And why is the answer top two? Are you ready to go anywhere to any of those three right now?
No, none of those. I mean, I don't think it matters whether they finish top two. Or, I mean, just getting to the World Cup really is really the only thing that matters. And but I guess when I do look at it and I look back at this and you reflect back on these matches, I don't know. Maybe after watching Canada play a little bit, I don't know. I'm still frustrated by that result. And I felt the U.S. could have done more to push the game in the second half. And I felt like there was something left there. And El Salvador came out. El Salvador did the same thing with the U.S. They didn't just completely sit back, but Canada punished them. They just had, and yes, they're playing at home. But the quality to be able to take a team that is trying to go toe-to-toe with you and just to act, just absolutely run them over, is a trait that I've seen Canada do that the U.S. have yet to been able to unlock to this point.
So even your point still, is, yes, they're a top two team in the region.
I would say right now. Yeah, I would say right now. I think there's a real argument to say that. But with this Canada team still, they still have something. They still have a lot to prove. They still have a lot to prove to themselves, I think. I think you're seeing that. I think you're seeing them grow. But I think they still have to prove to everybody as well that ultimately as it gets closer, as it gets harder, and the U.S. team has a lot to prove too. There's just a different kind of feeling, I guess, about the group. But the Canada team, the thing that I like about them is like they have that personality where they're in a perfect spot in a way because Mexico feels like they're maybe still overlooking them a little bit, or the U.S. feels like, ah, yeah, I see you guys, but like, you're still the little brother. And they're saying like they're looking across the room at each other and being like, okay, we are no longer that. and they're starting to prove it. So they're backing it up.
So the one thing we didn't really see, and while they, you know, Canada played the U.S. on the road, a true away CONCACAF experience for this Canadian team, and in qualifying, because they've had to play in qualifying longer than what the U.S. and Mexico and Honduras have, there was no away fans, or they didn't even travel for away games. They played a bunch in Florida, both home and away in the U.S. At Haiti, there was no fans there. So we're about to learn a ton, because Mexico's going to open up the next window at Canada's going to open up the next window at Mexico. And what we believe right now is Mexico will be allowed to have fans for the first time this entire cycle. So that one, as you see below us, October 7th, 9:40 p.m. Eastern time, that's where you learn, right? We've learned a lot about the U.S.
Honestly, no. If I'm Herdman, I play the backups in that one.
But the ability and belief, I think, whether you win or not,
yeah,
how you fair. Play in a moment like that, and then that entire window for this Canada team, they'll also travel to Jamaica in that window as well, and then they'll come home and play Panama. Jamaica didn't have fans in this cycle, but whatever it is, it's a different experience than what Canada had over the course of these three games.
For sure.
Is there any big Canada thing you want to say?
No, I would just say the 5 point, as well as they played, I don't want to say 5 points was the bare minimum, but like they had two very winnable home games. They only won one of them. So they do have more to prove, even though I think we all agree that, I mean, we all feel pretty good about Canada's chances of qualifying for the
World. But you'd have to say their point on the road was much better than the U.S.'s point on the road, right? Like the U.S. getting a point at El Salvador.
El Salvador, oh yeah, for sure.
If you go to the U.S. or you go to Mexico and you get a point, that's point that not everybody's grabbing. So that one almost counts a little bit. It shades the way I look at it a little bit, where they say, yeah, 5 points, maybe not the best. You drop points at home, but then you won. You got the point on the road that a lot of people are not expecting necessarily to get. So that feels like it does shade things a little bit to me, where the point looks a little bit different there, where you feel like you probably lost. There may be 1 point deficit that they feel like it takes kind of one off, and it's maybe a 1 point deficit than what they would have expected, where they could have taken 6 points for the week as opposed to five.
I agree with that.
And potentially the U.S. arrival in those final three spots lost two home points because of you, which, Doyle, you talked about coming into the window about potentially drawing at Honduras and hurting your opponent for their home games. Canada sort of did that, although they didn't obviously win all their home games. Can we talk about Brampton for a second?
Let's
Taylor,
go.
Do you have time for that?
Movement episode? Oh, it's on YouTube. We don't want people to click off, though. Stay on this.
You want them to move from the... Well, they'll go from this to the Ricardo Pepi El Paso episode.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
And then they'll go from that to the Brampton.
Binge it. It's not late or anything.
So there was a lot of really cool moments for Canada in this game, because this is a long time coming for them. They haven't been in this round of qualifying in this millennium, and they haven't had success like this in it in a very long time. So obviously, Atiba Hutchinson scores the first goal, 38 years old, from Brampton himself. And I think when you look at Atiba and his continued ability to come back and perform at a high level and fly across the world year after year to play for Canada in games where it didn't feel like they had a chance in front of crowds that were a quarter the size of what he did tonight, for him to get the first goal back in his hometown where a pro team existed, which didn't exist when he left, is pretty special and pretty cool. And then the night ended with Jonathan Osorio taking the drum from the supporters section that he plays in front of every single week at a stadium he grew up going to. And now he gets to play that drum as they do the clap. I thought that was one of the coolest moments of the night. And it just shows you the world we're living in from a soccer point of view in this region, and especially in Canada, is so different from what we grew up through and what a lot of these players grew up in as well. And shout out to Brampton.
So when you opened the show and you said live from the greatest city in the world, you never said New York. You actually meant Brampton, Ontario.
Yeah, Toronto, GTA.
Okay. Well, it is. I did, you know, in that piece, they did, when I was talking about the personality of the Canada team, it's kind of a Brampton attitude where it's got that chip on the shoulder. And also, even when you look at the profile, a lot of the players from Brampton or the players that play for Canada, there's a lot of players that have come from other countries, whether that be the Caribbean or the United States or other places, or Alfonso Davies, whose story is incredible, fantastic. The Whitecaps did a really good feature piece on him too. And then, you know, and you just see how much that can change the trajectory of an entire footballing nation and the way that they play. And then even when you look at today for the U.S. team, it's a perfect case with Ricardo Pepi too, where it's the same thing, where it's saying, oh, if only we had more like Latin players on our team that, you know, maybe instead of going to Mexico, they want to play for the U.S. and you choose the U.S. and then, you know, who knows? Like, look at what it's already done just in one match. And so it definitely is an interesting story that Brampton kind of thing. And even on the women's side, Kadisha Buchanan, Jessica, what's her name? Jessica
Fleming.
No, on the national team, I'm losing her last name. I totally should get it. But they've got a bunch of players that have come through that pipeline as well. Jessica Lawrence, I think. And
Ashley Lawrence.
Oh, Ashley Lawrence. Jeez. Sorry. Shout out to
we're
the
all
gold
we're
medal.
In this together. We're good.
It's late, but yeah, they it's definitely an interesting story. And then you also look at the growth of what TFC has meant as far as bringing a lot of these players through their academy.
And Doyle, you mentioned Junior Hoilett, what he's mm-hmm. done for the team, but to me, he stands out for what Kalen mentioned in terms of like being someone people can follow. This is a Brampton kid who had options for the national team. And when he chose Canada, while Julian de Guzman had already done it previous, separate from his brother, to me, that was the one that was the precedent that a lot of these guys have followed that have chosen Canada, where he legitimately had options. One of them was in the Caribbean with a country that his family was from, and he chose to represent Canada. And I think he's been a big part of bringing everyone else in underneath him and these young players flowering.
And it's a wonderful story, and it does feel like the beginning of something, just like a much better new era for Canadian soccer. And the fans there have been waiting for a while. Fans like me have been waiting for a good long while to get to that point. And it's nice to see. So let me ask you this, because I think we're just about to wrap. If you're, and I'm going to do this for both teams, so bear with me. If you're a Canada fan, are you satisfied after this window? And what do you want to hear the coach say, John Herdman say he wants to see something, he wants to see better next window?
If I'm a Canada fan, yes, I'm satisfied. It maybe isn't the exact amount of points that I wanted, but it was a first ever for a lot of these players. And it was a positive three games, a positive experience. And the first half against Honduras was the worst Canada played. So from that moment on, they progressively got better from that second half to the U.S. performance to a dominant performance at home. And that's all I want to see from this group, because that's all you can ask for is improvement from a group in a space they've never been before. But from John Herdman, I want to hear that he's not happy, that they could be better. And I want to keep up the view that he had in the second half at the U.S., which was we can win this game. Being in a moment like that and not being satisfied with what they've gotten, striving and expecting for more.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think the result tonight was huge, not just for the points, but I think also for sort of reestablishing that confidence of winning at home. And I think that's something that the U.S. still is a sort of a bridge we still have, or the U.S. still team still needs to cross. Although I'm rooting for the U.S. Come on, baby. But
just say us, and then you could say you meant to say the U.S.
There you go.
The same letters.
But their next match, Canada's next match, is, I think, away at Mexico. Yeah. And so I think that will be a really good test, but just as far as to see how Herdman approaches it. And do they take a more negative approach or pragmatic approach that they took against the US, which was to get behind the ball? You play the 5-4-1, you use, pace on the width, you send Tejan and Davies up and you say, good luck, Mexico. You're going to get frustrated eventually. The crowd's going to make you angsty, and then you start going the other direction? Or do they take a much more positive approach and say, let's go toe to toe? And maybe that's the personality of this Canada team. I think they should probably take the approach that worked versus the US, because I think they have the personality for it. I think they have the discipline for it, and they have the weapons that even if they just were to get one or two opportunities, and we've seen this done by top national teams in the past, or even just, even you look around in the region with Costa Rica in the past and World Cup teams and teams that have just been really solid defensively or gotten numbers behind the ball and then try to use some difference makers on the break. But I don't think we've seen difference makers on the break like this Canada team. So they seem uniquely positioned to play that style. And it'll be interesting to see how they kind of approach that first match against Mexico.
Okay, same question, but for the U.S., and I'm going to add a bit to it as well. How confident are you in Greg Berhalter? His decision-making ability with regard to picking rosters, picking lineups, and making tactical changes?
Ooh, I think tonight was a difficult one, and I would say shook my confidence in that trust, mainly because, and I said in the last game I think I defended Berhalter to say that I think he was backed into a corner because of the decisions or the personnel decisions that weren't available or the tough decisions he had to make. But I think my main critique or criticism of that is when things get complicated and you're against the wall and you lose a guy and you lose the next guy and you lose the next guy, that's a time for me to simplify. And I think what ended up happening was the other direction, where it started to get a lot more complex and we started to try and figure it out in a way that seemed to overcomplicate things, as opposed to saying, you know what, my guys might not all be 100% fit and I'm not in those conversations with everybody to make those decisions or to understand them, but to say 4-3-3, I need to play different players, but I'm going to at least use the same system that these guys have been training or understand, as opposed to really turning everything on its head. The only thing I'll say is, and why I do have faith that things will turn around, is the learning curve has been quick, where we saw the late substitutions in the last match, whereas this one, okay, clearly didn't work. And I haven't heard his post-game comments or anything like that, but that he at least held his hand up with the substitutions, if that's just not an indication to change things around then. And then it got a little better and better and better from there. So I think this young group has a lot of a learning curve, and we saw some of that on the good side with Brendan Aaronson and Robinson, some guys that have really stepped up. And then we've seen it even on the managerial side, I think, where if you haven't been through World Cup qualifiers, and this is a unique one too, where you've got COVID absences and suspensions, and he was tested for sure through this window to keep the locker room, to make tough decisions, to bench players, to send them home, and to make in-game substitutions. And at the end of the day, he got it right in the second half. So we come away with 5 points. I say it's acceptable. And considering everything it went and where we were not too long ago, I feel pretty darn good about that. And I think it also makes me hopeful that things, when you get the group together, it gets together, but it's when things get bad, it's a time for me to simplify. And I think that's the main criticism I had for where I think he got it wrong heading into this match.
I agree with most of what Kalen said. I think I told you 2 weeks ago when we did one of the shows, if the US got 4 points out of this window, I wasn't jumping off the cliff. Mm-hmm. And they got 5 points. So I can't complain about that. In terms of Greg Berhalter and where he stands, there's clearly an issue with when he has time to prepare, overthinking it and overdoing it. That is fixable. That is like the least of my problems, in terms of you can ID it pretty quickly, and you've got Ernie Stewart, Brian McBride, and a coaching staff to talk through it with Greg Berhalter and figure out how to be better next time. But we haven't had a coach of the U.S. national team, sorry, us, U.S., that's how I pronounce it, in 10 years that would see what they planned go wrong and change it and admit they were wrong, not just to the players, right? When you make three substitutions at halftime, you're admitting you were wrong on national or international television, and to change it and be able to get a result out of that. And so I think he has a relationship with these players that works. I think there is a culture in this team of winning based off this summer and what we've seen over the course of this window. And I think there's a connection between these players and this coach and this group. Not everything tactically is perfect right now, but there's a willingness to change. There's an openness to figuring it out. And I think over the course of this qualifying, it's going to end better than it started. And we saw that already in the first window. So I'll take that over what we've experienced over the last decade. And I'll take that over what some other coaches and what other some of the other teams in this region are dealing with. Because there's a pretty good chance that in a day or two, Honduras is going to be without a head coach. Costa Rica has a coach that they hired a month ago that they're not crazy about. And you've got question marks across the rest of the region. And I think the U.S. doesn't sit in a bad place right now.
And just to go back to where we started, when I came into the World Cup qualifying cycle, my biggest two questions were still left back and the number nine position. And, you know, Serginho Dest is another story we'll talk about.
You're glowing right now, Caleb.
But I'll say, Anthony Robinson, I think, proved a lot this World Cup qualifying cycle. And I think today, Ricardo Pepi, which is where we began this episode, and maybe close to where we'll finish it, is kind of the revelation of just like, not just because of the goal, but because of the importance of it, the timing of it, the pressure on it, the circumstance, the location. I feel like it was a really big moment. and somebody that I think can actually grow. And when you said, I don't know if he could do much better, I think he actually can do much better. I think we've seen before where he, on the ball that gets knocked back, he could finish that, or the one that he usually finishes the other one that I think Legette ended up tapping in. Mm-hmm. But he could have come away with two goals in this one. So I mean,
he had a hand in four goals.
He did. He did fantastic. I'm not questioning Pepe at all.
Kalen, do you look better in red or in blue?
What's that?
Do you look better in red or blue?
I'm more of a blue guy. Yeah.
Okay. I'm trying to figure out if Miles Robinson's going to go to Inter Milan or AC Milan in the January window. So I figured he would probably take that in consideration, which jersey he should wear, because he is the best center back in this region. He might be the best player on the U.S. men's national team. And what a world we live in. What a night it was. Canada gets a 3-0 win at home. Two goals in the first 10 minutes. Atiba Hutchinson with the opener. They win their
Wait,
first
Gus, home. Can I jump in real quick? Because Doyle didn't answer the questions. I just want to ask Doyle.
Doyle never does.
On the U.S. side of things, from where you are, how much trust do you have in Berhalter and the team to get heading into this next cycle?
I trust the team to be talented and tough and to not play scared. I thought they played scared the first 2.5 games. I think that they'll have moved past that. My trust for Berhalter not overcomplicating things is very low. I still think that he's always going to have a tendency to try to identify the one particular thing about El Salvador's press that makes him think that he can, you know, play Serginho as a inverted left winger or left fullback because there's this one pass that he wants to hit. And, you know, like, no, man, just like, you guys are really good when you play the 4-3-3 with the back point and you know, impose that upon the opposition with no bells and whistles. Do that. I don't trust him to do that. I do trust the players to be talented and to play hard. I do think that they'll play better. I do think that this is a team that's going to make the World Cup. I just think that at this point in the cycle for, and not just this World Cup cycle, I mean the cycle for all of these players who are all like 23 or younger, that you can't throw them out there in a different formation, in a different position, with different principles of play every single game. This isn't Italy 2006. You know, it's not a bunch of 31-year-olds who have played for Trapattoni and, you know, Zanotti and Sacchi their entire lives and are completely flexible. It's not that, like, we don't have that culture here. We're still try hard, run fast, right? That's who we are. It's who we've always been. And I think we can add more elegance and more grace and more savvy to that. And I think that's what Berhalter wants to do, but I think sometimes he conflates that with being really clever tactically when he doesn't need to. And so I do think that this is going to be a World Cup team. I need to see, you know, the coach develop a little pragmatism in the same way that the players have developed that savvy and that pragmatism as well.
Eddie Pope got screwed. DeMarcus Beasley didn't affect that shot. 06 Italy team was a farce. And on that note, our beloved Ricardo Pepi says night over. It was a fantastic night for Canada. Fantastic night for the U.S. We'll be doing this show coming up in October after that next round of games coming up. So as I said, the U.S. starts at home against Jamaica and Canada goes on the road to the Azteca in front of, we believe, a full stadium of fans. It is all coming to. This was the first round of World Cup qualifying. It was unbelievable to watch. It was great to be joined with you two. I think maybe Andrew Wiebe is going to come back, although rumor is he only stays in countries that have qualified for the men's side of the Olympic soccer competition. So maybe he'll be in Honduras next time. I don't know. It's like a really big deal to him. But thanks for joining us. This was Extra Time, driven by Continental Club and Country from the AT&T 5G studios. And on that note, good night, everyone.